You're listening to the National Radio Club's
TX Audio Service, National Radio Club.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for June 2013. This is issue number 340, and I'm your publisher, Fred Vobey. The address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. Email for general inquiries is fvobe@realoldiesradio.com. That's F-V-O-B-B-E. And my telephone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S.-Canadian members is $30. To subscribe or renew, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated. And send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal. Subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone's assistance. Time now to take a look at the AM Switch column. Here's our Los Angeles correspondent, Dave Alpert.
Now let's take a look at the AM Switch, volume 80, numbers 26 and 27, starting off with call letter changes. The new station on 740 in Kahi, Alaska, will be KCIK. The new station on 1240 in Altamont, Oregon, will be assigned the calls KRJW. 1280 KPTQ in Spokane, Washington, has changed its name to KZFS. On the air, 740 KBRT, now in Costa Mesa, California. The CP for this U4 50,000-watt day and 190-watt nighttime signal moving from Avalon is on the air. 800 KBRV, Soda Springs, Idaho, had a CP to move from 790, and it's now fully licensed and has been broadcasting on 800 with program test authority for well over a year. 820 WBKK, Wilton, Minnesota. This new station, now fully licensed, CP has been on the air for several months using program test authority. 980 KMIN, Grants, New Mexico, has been granted program test authority for the CP for U1 5,000 watts day and 230 watts night. On 1090, KQNM, Milan, New Mexico's CP for D1 250 watts, moving from 1100 kilohertz, is now on the air. 1120 KTXW, Manor, Texas, has been granted modification to their CP for new station to U4 5600 watts day, 155 watts night, to raise night power from 153 watts. They also applied for program test authority, so it may soon be on. 1250 KZDC, San Antonio, Texas, their CP for U4 25,000 watts day and 920 watts night is on. 1440 WHDM McKenzie, Tennessee, applies for license to cover their CP for U1 420 watts day and 91 watts at night. And 1520 KKXA, Snohomish, Washington, has been granted program test authority for their CP for U6 50,000 watts day and night. Off the air, 1230 KQIK, Lakeview, Oregon. License canceled, calls deleted, per an FCC letter dated April 12th. It appears they've been silent for over a year and failed to respond to FCC inquiries. 1450 WDLK, Dadeville, Alabama, has had its license canceled and calls deleted. The license wasn't renewed, as the station seems to have been off the air without FCC authorization for some time. And just a reminder, if you hear a station off the air, please let us know on the DXAS Musings line so we can pass it on to the folks on the print side of the NRC. CPs granted to existing stations. 1140 KYOK, Conroe, Texas, granted a CP to move to Katy, Texas, with U4 800 watts day and 9 watts night. 1330 WMLT, Dublin, Georgia. Granted a CP for U1, a kilowatt day, 12 watts at night. 1400 WIEL, Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Granted a construction permit to move to a new transmitter site. Applications from existing stations. 590 WLES, Bonaire, Virginia, applies for U1, 1,000 watts day and 58 at night. 730 WZGV, Cremerton, North Carolina, has a CP for U1, 10,000 watts day and 178 watts night, and applied to modify that CP to U1, 10,000 watts day and 185 watts night. Now it amends the application to U1, 10,000 watts day and 165 watts night on FCC staff advice. Sometimes the FCC will toss a bone to a broadcaster to help them get a CP passed. 810 WRSO, Orlo Vista, Florida, applies for construction permit to U4, 10,000 watts day and 1,000 watts night. They're presently licensed for U4, 10,000 watts day and 400 at night. 1120 WNWF, Destin, Florida, applies for U1, 3 kilowatts day, 12 watts night, and critical hours power of 2,400 watts at their current site, as well as a move from 1120 to 1140 kilohertz. 1330 WNIX, Greenville, Mississippi, has a CP for U1, 1,000 watts day and 55 watts night. They now apply to modify that CP to U1, 3,800 watts day and 55 at night. And 1360 WELR, Roanoke, Alabama, corrects a typo in their previous application. The application is to stay at U1, 1,000 watts day and 54 night, and not increase night power to 540 watts. However, they do want to do all their changes from a new site. CPs expiring and applications dismissed. The 1090 CP in Providence, Utah, for a new station, which would have been U2, 5 kilowatts day and 250 watts at night, has expired and it's now deleted. 1160 WCXI, Fenton, Michigan, a suburb of Flint, had a construction permit for U4, 15,000 watts day and 215 at night. That has now expired and been removed from the database. Undaunted, the station has applied for the same parameters again. 1210 WDGR, Dahlonega, Georgia, had a construction permit for U4, 20,000 watts day, a mighty 1-watt night, and critical hours power of 12 kilowatts, moving to Lawrenceville, Georgia. That has expired and has been deleted from the database. 1220 WOTS in Kissimmee, Florida, had a CP for U4, 2,500 watts day, 210 watts night. It's expired, so WOTA will remain U1, 1,000 watts day and 110 watts night. 1380 WRAB, Arab, Alabama, had a CP to change city of license to Union Grove. That CP was dismissed by the FCC. Good, they won't have to change their call letters now. A quick look at Special Temporary Authority. 710 KNUS, Denver, granted an STA for pattern out of tolerance. 730 KWOA in Worthington, Minnesota, has an STA for U1, 350 watts day and 200 watts at night from a temporary long wire antenna because an ice storm in April took down their tower. 740 KBRT, we mentioned them a few minutes ago, they have an STA for U1, 10,000 watts day and 113 watts at night due to an equipment failure on April 30th after firing up that new site in Costa Mesa, California. 750 KAMA, El Paso, Texas, granted STA for U3, 10 kilowatts day, 500 watts night, using only their day pattern, 24 hours. 940 WGFP, Webster, Massachusetts, granted an STA for emergency long wire antenna due to tower problems. 950 KSEW, Seward, Alaska, applies for an STA for U1, 200 watts day and night from a temporary antenna. They need to build a new transmitter site, but they've been having trouble getting it finished. 1340 WJOL, Joliet, Illinois. Granted an SDA for U1 710 watts day and night due to tower work after a lightning strike. 1360 WNJC, Washington Township, New Jersey. Applies for SDA for U1 1,250 watts day, 200 watts night, due to vandalism at their antenna site, which precludes operation with directional antenna. 1390 KTCR, Yakima, Washington, is granted STA for reduced night power, which they have not specified due to pattern problems. Their day pattern is unaffected. 1440 KKLO, Leavenworth, Kansas, applies for STA for U1, 1,250 watts day and 250 watts night, for testing. 1470 WMBD, Peoria, Illinois, granted STA for U1 3,800 watts day and 1,250 watts night after a catastrophic lightning strike on April 10th on one of their antenna towers used in both day and night patterns. 1480 KBXD, Dallas, Texas, applies for STA. They had been using their CP for U4, 50,000 watts day and 1,900 watts night for 30 days based on its application for program test authority. Since the PTA has not been granted, the station applies for STA instead to keep the CP powers. 1510 WFAI, Salem, New Jersey, granted STA for D1 with reduced unspecified power due to damage to their directional antenna system. 1590 WCGO, Evanston, Illinois, applies for STA for U2 7,000 watts day, 625 watts night, while they work on their night pattern. Silent STAs and silent station notifications. 580 KZMX, Hot Springs, South Dakota, applies for silent STA. They went off on April 26th following a brief time on the air. 830 KMUL, Farwell, Texas, is back on, effective May 1st, with U1, 10 watts, day and night. 860 KARS, Belen, New Mexico, applies for silent STA, as they've been off the air since March 28th, while they complete their move to 840. 980 KICA, Clovis, New Mexico, back on the air. 1060 KRUZ, Van Buren, Arkansas, applies for a silent STA, as they've been silent since March 16th for technical reasons and lack of security at their transmitter site. 1060 WHFB, Benton Harbor, St. Joseph, Michigan. This silent station returned to the air on April 2nd to broadcast from 8:30 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon, then went silent again. Efforts continue to sell the station to new owners. 1110 WOMN, Franklinton, Louisiana, applies for silent STA. They've been off since March 28th for technical reasons. 1160 WIWA, St. Cloud, Florida. This formerly silent station was back on the air as of April 19th, but applied for a new silent STA and promptly went silent again the next day with transmitter problems. 1230 KVOC, Casper, Wyoming, back on the air effective April 29th with an STA. 1330 WJSS, Havre de Grace, Maryland, applies for silent STA. They went silent on April 15th for financial reasons. 1330 WFNN, Erie, Pennsylvania, has been off the air since April 4th due to transmitter problems. 1340 WALH, Mountain City, Georgia, applies for a silent STA. They went off back on April 9th due to a loss of transmitter site. 1400 WGHC, Clayton, Georgia, silent as of April 13th as the lease on their transmitter site expires April 30th and a new one needs to be found. 1420 KTSN, Elko, Nevada, applies for silent STA for transmitter work. 1420 WRSA, St. Albans, Vermont, silent due to lack of audio path to the transmitter. I wonder if a phone line or STL could help. 1450 SNY, Snyder, Texas. This formerly silent station is back on the air. 1490 KFCR, Custer, South Dakota, applies for a silent STA. They went off again on April 26th after a brief time on the air. 1490 WBSS, Pleasantville, New Jersey, formerly silent station, back on as of April 2nd. 1490 WFAD, Middlebury, Vermont, has been silent since April 1st due to a PA failure. That's a power amplifier, a part of the transmitter that makes the big watts. 1520 WVOH, Spindale, North Carolina, applies for silent STA. WVOH has been off since April 9th for financial reasons. 1550 WVAB, Virginia Beach, Virginia, as expected, went silent again April 8th and now applies for a new silent STA. 1570 WIZK, Bay Springs, Mississippi, applies for a silent STA. They've been off since February 10th after a storm took out their tower. 1580 KAMI, Cozad, Nebraska, applies for silent STA. They had a lightning strike on their tower back on April 10th and are still trying to resolve it. And DXAS members report KMPH 840, Modesto, California, WNEM 1250, Bridgeport, Michigan, and WDLK 1450, Dadeville, Alabama, are also silent. In otherness, 690 CBQM, Fort McPherson, Northwest Territories, low power relay transmitter applies to move to 99.9. The CP for 700 CJLI, Calgary, Alberta, has disappeared from the Industry Canada database. Presumably, it's expired. Industry Canada, of course, is the Canadian version of the FCC. 750 CBFA3, Waymontachi, Quebec. This LPRT was granted a CP to move to 92.3, so it should be gone for good from medium wave real soon. 830 CKKY, Wainwright, Alberta, granted a CP to move to 101.9. And a correction on 920 CFRY, Portage La Prairie, Manitoba. Their application is not to shut down the AM station, but simply to convert the simulcast on CFRY FM 1, 93.1, into a freestanding station. AM is alive and well in Manitoba, after all. 1230 CBQC, Fort Providence, Northwest Territories. This LPRT applies to move to 98.9. 1240 CBLS, Sioux Lookout, Ontario. Another low-power relay transmitter granted a construction permit to move to 95.3. The new FM will also make CBQW 1340, Hudson, Ontario, redundant. They will go off the air as well. And finally, 1270 CBGA6 in Murdochville, Quebec. This LPRT was granted a CP to move to 97.7 FM. And that is it for this edition of the AM Switch. Before we go, I'd like to remind you about the 2013 NRC Convention, August 1st through the 4th. It's called Learning and Sharing 2013, and will combine formal tutorials and technical sessions, gab gatherings, a de-expedition, and ideas on how to enhance radio listening. Show and tell, new antenna designs, and DX stories will be combined with information on receiver improvements and propagation. The hotel selected for the 2013 convention is the Holiday Inn Bloomington South Airport Mall in Minneapolis. Make your hotel reservations right now to get the special convention rate. Call the Holiday Inn at 952-884-8211. Use the registration code NRC to obtain the special convention rate of $73 per night plus tax. Cost for convention registration is $45. This includes breakfast each day and the Saturday night banquet, as well as the amenities at the Museum of Broadcasting and the Friday evening pizza fest at the museum. Your check or money order should be made payable to the National Radio Club. Send it to Skip Dabblestein at 8008 North Iron Ridge Drive, Tucson, Arizona, 85743-1065. You can contact Skip Dabblestein via email at ckdabel@comcast.net. Once you're registered, we'll send you an information form so we can learn about your special needs and interests. Please register early so we can include you on pre-convention information. You can also register for the convention online using PayPal. Please note there is a $1 PayPal fee. If you have any questions, please contact Fred, and he'll get you in touch with the right person or will answer your questions. And now, here's one of the hosts for this year's convention, Mark Durenberger.
Well, thank you, David. A couple of months ago, we began what was to be a two-part report from New England, but so far, we've made it through the 1,000s frequencies, and we have a long way to go. So we can forge ahead this month, picking up at 1,100. But I have a better idea. Let's can these IDs for a month or so, and instead, take an early timeout for our Midsummer Madness.
All new and in flaming Technicolor.
Radio bloopers is what most of our show is about today. Unless you've lived in the Twin Cities for a while, you probably aren't aware that world-famous Best Buy began as a small string of electronics stores around here called Shock, S-C-H-A-A-K. Early on, founder Dick Schultz legitimized the power of radio by taking to the airwaves to grow his small store chain. That meant a lot of advertising, and he used the best voices in the market for his commercials. Today we're going to step inside the recording studio for a few moments to see how easy or hard it was to put these commercials together. The voices are those of famous classical actors, one of whom is wrestling with how to pronounce the name of a new company that was just entering the consumer world. That company is spelled S-O-N-Y.
What is it, Sony or
Sony? Sony, yeah. Yes, right, yes.
Sony.
What is it?
Sony, like bony. Bony. Bony, Sony. Just feel your elbow when you're in doubt.
Okay.
Bony.
Sony 34.
Elbow.
I got so, bow, elbow.
So. Bow. So. Bow. Sony, Bodhi.
Sony 34.
I came past four other electric stores to choose Sony.
Sir.
Electronic stores, sir.
Well,
electric stores. No, that's a different kind of store with a plug, sir. Transistorized store,
I'm
sir.
So hard to get Sony.
Japanese store, sir. Transistorized.
Uh-oh. Okay.
Battery's not included in the store, sir.
I came past four other electronic stores to choose Sony stereo equipment at a Shock electronics store.
You made a wise decision, sir.
But I'll bet those four other electronic stores sell Sony, too.
Sony offers one of the biggest, finest lines.
Oh, boy.
Here we go. Sony, 35.
I came past four other electronic stores to choose Sonios.
Not Sonio. That's the Italian version of Sony, sir. Sonio.
What fun they had. It's almost as if they were on salary. Local Freeway Ford paid the salaries of the actors on a commercial in which they played with pronunciations. Follow along. They were doing pretty well until the lady tried reading ahead.
Welcome to Freeway Ford Service Department this fine evening, ma'am.
Yes, I want a wool alignment.
Wool alignment?
Yes, that's a wheel alignment with an O in it.
You're confusing us with Freeway Ford Sales Department, where they give the duels.
And a duel is a deal with an O in it.
Right.
But Freeway Ford's fine service department stays open till midnight. That's some duel, too.
Well, we aim to pluse.
Pluse?
Is please with an O in it.
Yes.
Anything other than a wool alignment there, ma'am?
I could use a tune, teen, teen up, tune.
That's all right. Just keep on going, ma'am.
You were so loose. I was so teat.
Don't change a thing.
And now for a perspective on how America was accepting our form of radio broadcasting in the 1930s. There was, at large, some groundswell of opinion against the American form of commercial-driven programming and the possibility that government was censoring radio. Some thought we should model our radio system after the European non-commercial method, government-controlled. At the time, it made for interesting arguments. Veteran radio broadcaster Bulk Carter aired a series on this issue and others on CBS during the time James A. Farley was postmaster of the United States. That would have been in the first terms of FDR's reign, so 1936, we'll say. The two came together on this broadcast. It's a rather scratchy recording, but it's interesting to hear the way they spoke on the radio 75 years ago. Bulk Carter always sounded over the top. You have a mental picture of him cupping his hand to his ear and closing his eyes as he got into what he was saying. Farley, on the other hand, sounds like he's giving a speech to a large audience. Mr. Farley's opening comments are particularly interesting in the light of what we know has happened to radio in our own lifetime.
The Columbia Network presents at this time the third in a series of discussions on the subject broadcasting and the American public. In the course of this series, distinguished citizens will be interviewed by Bulk Carter, well-known news commentator, on their views concerning the broadcasting industry and its relation to the American public which it serves. This evening, Mr. Carter will interview the Honorable James A. Farley, Postmaster General of the United States. Mr. Carter.
Hello, everyone. Well, again, we seek information concerning that vital question of the freedom of the air in America and some of the problems facing radio in the nation today. And with me is Postmaster General James A. Farley, of course, whose accomplishments and many victories and hundreds of political campaigns need no introduction. Mr. Postmaster General, those of us identified in one way or another with the radio broadcasting industry are naturally concerned with the recent onslaughts against radio itself growing out of allegations of unfairness in the handling of political broadcasts. And it's for us here to review what has happened. But I'm sure our listeners would like to get some word from you as a political leader as to your attitude toward radio. So first let me ask you this tonight. What do you think of the system of American broadcasting, and by that I mean our American system of open competitive enterprise, as against the European systems of strict governmental monopoly control?
I don't think for a moment the American people would stand for a monopoly of our broadcasting facilities, either in the hands of a single private company or in the hands of the government.
Well, I agree with you.
Though I am no expert on radio matters, I don't see that the radio monopoly problem, either private monopoly or governmental monopoly, ever faces this country. As I understand it, there are something like 640 or 50 broadcasting stations in the United States. I'm informed that these represent more than 600 separate corporate enterprises in almost as many different hands. I'm told also that these 600 or more separate licenses hold their franchises by reason of their pioneering ventures into the radio field or by reason of purchased acquisitions. That doesn't look like monopoly to me, and it doesn't look like partisan control either. As for the affiliation of these stations with networks, there are three national chains and a half a dozen or more regional chains. And if the stations subscribe to their chain services at their own volition, exactly as newspapers would subscribe to the Associated Press, United Press, or International News Service.
Let's talk about what these broadcasters put on the air. Are you satisfied that they are doing a good job of programming?
I regard myself, Mr. Carter, as a typical American listener. Frankly, I don't see how they do it. I think radio offers the greatest show on earth every night. There are certain programs I always look forward to. News flashes, for example, and the fine musical and comedy programs. Of course, that probably could be some improvements in radio. But what couldn't be improved in this life? But as a radio fan, I can't say I or any other one man should be the one to tell the radio where to improve itself.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say you like radio so much, Mr. Farley. Well, now, do you think a reputable and accredited news commentator, for instance, should be allowed to be the sole judge of what he shall say and how he shall say it, regardless of any policies which private companies might try to dictate to him?
My personal opinion is that experienced and qualified news commentators should have that right. These commentators are men and women of wide experience and mature minds. I can't imagine any public danger that would arise from allowing them to express their opinions freely.
Do you see any dangers now or later on in the way radio is being handled in this country, either as an entertainment, an educational, or a political medium?
It has been my experience that almost any field of public service improves with age, with long consideration of the problems involved. Radio is a public service and is still quite young. Only about 15 years old, or perhaps a bit older. It seems to be vitally sensitive to public opinion and public desire. Communications Act makes Congress and the people the final judge. While there are complaints, some legitimate and some otherwise, I know of no crying abuse in the radio broadcasting field which needs adjustment. If any grave wrong is attempted by the radio people, you may be sure the American people will be quick to make well known in overwhelming fashion. The present method of control and regulation seems to be working fairly well.
Well, very, very many thanks indeed, Mr. Postmaster General, for being so good as to do me the honor tonight of coming to take part in this forum of ours. After all, it's only by such an exchange of views that we can get anywhere in this world, radio or otherwise or anything else.
You have been listening to a discussion between the Honorable James A. Farley, Postmaster General of the United States and Chairman of the National Democratic Committee, and Mr. Bolt Carter on the subject, broadcasting and the American public. The Columbia Network has presented this program in the belief that its listeners are interested in free and frank discussion of radio, which is assuming increasing importance in our national life.
Well, now, hardly an exchange of views. It was as though CBS and Bolt Carter had set up Mr. Farley, knowing all he would do was compliment what Columbia and others were doing. But that's what listeners heard on the subject back in 1936. My, how times have changed. Next, it's been 75 years since Edward R. Murrow first opened a microphone in Vienna, Austria, to begin a storied career as the preeminent news broadcaster and analyst in American history. Murrow's impact on the radio you hear today is minimal at best, but while he strode the earth, he was a giant. And he made a difference, inspiring generations of newscasters and shaping the news product as a legitimate force in radio. Before it succumbed to financial pressure, in a CBS radio series, Eric Severide, himself no shrinking violet in the business, memorialized Murrow's life in 6 minutes.
Ed Murrow was director of talks for CBS in those days of the late 30s when war was infiltrating Europe. He was asked to go to Europe for CBS, and he did, traveling about, covering stories, hiring me and other reporters to tell about the war. Murrow put his roots down in Great Britain. The wartime broadcast that began This is London told America of the British fight for survival. September 3rd, 1939.
This is London calling Columbia, New York. Now first, let's get in proper order the chronological developments of the day. At 9 o'clock this morning, London time, it was announced that a two-hour ultimatum had been delivered to Germany, that at the end of that time, hostilities must cease, or Germany and Britain would be at war. At 11:15, the Prime Minister spoke to the nation. He stated that no reply had been received to the ultimatum, and that Britain and Germany were at war.
Murrow worked in a blitz, including in his stories the vignettes about how people lived at war. He brought listeners to his rooftop during an air raid, September 22nd, 1940.
The plane is still very high, and it's quite clear that he's not coming in for his bombing run. Earlier this evening, we could hear occasionally, again, those were explosions overhead. Earlier this evening, we heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away. Just overhead now, the burst of the anti-aircraft fire. Still, the nearby guns are not working, and the searchlights now are feeling almost directly overhead. Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
Ed Murrow, against the wishes of the people he worked for, went along on bombing runs over Germany. His account of a raid December 3rd, 1943, became known as Orchestrated Hell.
The bomb doors were open. Boz called his directions. Five left, five left. And then there was a gentle, confident upward thrust under my feet, and Boz said, "Cookie gone." A few seconds later, the incendiaries went, and D-Dog seemed lighter and easier to handle. I began to breathe and to reflect again that all men would be brave if only they could leave their stomachs at home. I looked on the fourth beam at the target area. There was a red, sullen, obscene glare. The fires seemed to have found each other. and we were heading home. Berlin was a kind of orchestrated hell, a terrible symphony of light and flame.
Near the end of the war, Murrow was with the first Allied reporters to enter the concentration camp of Buchenwald. In his report, he suggested that listeners who didn't wish to hear about such things should turn off their radios.
As he walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it. In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only 6. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. We proceeded to the small courtyard. There were 2 rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. I tried to count them as best I could, and arrived at the conclusion that all that was mortal of more than 500 men and boys lay there in 2 neat piles. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation. They had not been executed. But the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald.
The most controversial broadcast of his career was a television documentary about Senator Joseph McCarthy's hunt for communists. In his closing essay, Murrow said the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and that the junior senator from Wisconsin had stepped over it repeatedly. March 9th, 1954.
We will not walk in fear, one of another. We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason if we dig deep in our history and our doctrine, and remember that we are not descended from fearful men. Not from men who feared to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were for the moment unpopular. The actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have caused alarm and dismay amongst our allies abroad and given considerable comfort to our enemies. And whose fault is that? Not really his. He didn't create this situation of fear. He merely exploited it, and rather successfully. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
In 1961, Murrow left CBS to head the U.S. Information Agency. In 1963, he was operated on for cancer. On Tuesday, April 27, 1965, he died. The Sunday before had been his 57th birthday. As we hear again these old broadcasts, we remember that high furrowed forehead, the ever-present cigarette, the short, lean sentences, the vivid description, the courage, and the dedication. If I may quote myself from that day when he died, he was a shooting star, and we will live in his afterglow a very long time. This is Eric Severide.
And in closing, back to the lighter side. Here's a recording from over at big-time CBS affiliate WCCO, where Farm Director Maynard Spies is introducing his friend Dr. William A. O'Brien for a serious morning piece on healthcare. This was in the days when WCCO had more than 50% of the audience share. Commercial time cost more than $1,000 a minute. With time that valuable, you couldn't waste a moment. Dr. O'Brien, who's normally this staid, serious gentleman, walked into the studio on a bitterly cold winter morning, dressed in a heavy sweater and short shorts. Maynard took one look and started to lose it. Well, Dr. O'Brien began to peel off the top layers, starting with the sweater, and continuing until he had taken off 6 or 7 layers of topwear. Halfway through this, someone tried turning off the studio light so Maynard couldn't see what was happening and could maybe regain control of the airwaves. I mean, sheesh, $1,000 a minute.
Good morning, everybody. This is Maynard Spies with another in our series of programs on your health. Our guest again this morning, Dr. William A. O'Brien.
I'll try once more. Pete, you're doing it deliberately. Why don't you just turn the light on instead of looking at me?
Also on WCCO, you heard the Minnesota Twins during their early years when first-class announcers like Ray Scott and Minneapolis newspaper Dean Halsey Hall did the play-by-play. If you're a veteran of this column, you've heard Halsey's distinctive laugh.
The throw was in the dirt and skipped by Versalles. And Richardson, up in a flash, out of his slide and was easily into third.
Well, then, what are we laughing at here?
A count of ball one and strike two on Hector Lopez. A glance at third by Daly. 1-2 pitch. Swing, and there's a drive to right headed for the corner, and Allison off to his left, can't get it. The ball will roll to the fence. Lopez around first. He's at second. He's trying for third. Allen's throw to third, and he is safe. Halsey, I think you'd better tell the folks what we're laughing at.
Tom Breyer, the baseball writer for the Minneapolis Tribune, has been beating the bejabers out of his typewriter.
One of those little vignettes of life, Tommy Breyer's, the lid of his typewriter just won't go down, and he's done everything but sit on it, and he's making a lot of noise.
Well, folks, that's all the time we have. Now from a word for our sponsor.
I'm sorry.
You couldn't do that again if you tried.
We're all very tired, sir.
We want to go home.
That's right.
And that, friends, is this summer's Midsummer Madness, a bit early perhaps, but it was a nice change. Next month, we'll get back to work and complete, or at least try to complete, our series of IDs from the New England states. We got a great lineup of band scans coming your way through the rest of the year. We hope you'll be able to stay right here at this very same CD. And we hope to see you in Minneapolis at the Combined DX Convention. If you have not registered, please do so as soon as you can. Hotel rooms are filling up. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Hope you'll be right here 30 days from now. Until then, good listening, DXers.
Stevie Wonder to receive the NABEF Leadership Award. Legendary singer-songwriter Stevie Wonder will receive the 2013 Service to America Leadership Award from the National Association of Broadcasters Education Foundation for his important work as an activist, messenger of peace, and his dedication to helping people with disabilities and children and families in need. Wonder, who is one of the most creative musical figures of the late 20th century, will receive the award at the NABEF's Celebration to Service to America Gala on June the 3rd. The Service to America Leadership Award recognizes individuals and organizations responsible for improving the lives of others through extraordinary public service. Stevie Wonder has touched millions of lives worldwide through his musical genius and through his tireless contributions as a humanitarian, said NABEF President Marcellus Alexander. It is for his extraordinary efforts on behalf of those in need that we proudly honor him with this prestigious award. Stevie has amassed 32 number one singles, 49 top 40 singles, 25 Grammy Awards, including the prestigious Lifetime Achievement Award, a Golden Globe, and an Academy Award. He has been inducted into the Rock and Roll and Songwriters Halls of Fame, was the youngest recipient at the Kennedy Center Honors, and became the second recipient of the Library of Congress's Gershwin Prize for Popular Song. He has been pivotal in U.S. and world events. In 1983, he spearheaded a campaign in the U.S. to make Martin Luther King Day a national holiday, and his advocacy for ending apartheid in South Africa is legendary. As an artist, songwriter, and producer concerned with major humanitarian issues, his voice has lent itself to charities in support of disabilities, AIDS, cancer, diabetes, hunger, homelessness, domestic abuse, and numerous other causes on behalf of children and adults. His numerous awards include recognition from the U.S. President's Committee on Employment of Handicapped People, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the Children's Diabetes Foundation, and the American Association of People with Disabilities. For 17 years, he's provided toys and gifts of joy for children and families in need with his annual House Full of Toys benefit concert. As a designated UN messenger of peace, with special focus on persons with disabilities, he continues to demonstrate for activism that has made him such a vital voice for social progress. In case you're curious, Stevie Wonder's Billboard Hot 100 number ones include Fingertips Part 2, Superstition, You Are the Sunshine of My Life, You Haven't Done Nothing, I Wish, Sir Duke, and I Just Called to Say I Love You. From Dallas, Texas, Wally Warrow for the DX Audio Service.
In the past 10 years, we've seen the death of analog television and the birth of digital TV. And we also saw the Federal Communications Commission take away the 700 megahertz band from TV broadcasters on the premise of giving it to Homeland Security, but instead giving it to private interests for wireless use. Now the Federal Communications Commission and Congress are at it again, another land grab, so to speak, of channels 31 on up. Here's Chris Gay with a story which is impacting LPTV, or low-power television broadcasters.
This article is titled, Low Powers Have High Anxiety Over REPAC, by Andrew Dodson, in TV News Check from May 16, 2013. Passionate operators of most low-power television stations are afraid the upcoming incentive auction and subsequent channel REPAC will severely damage or even destroy their sector of the broadcast industry. Except for the Class A variety, LPTV stations can't participate in the voluntary auction, and they also won't be included in the FCC's database when the channel repack takes place, says Peter Tannenwald, an attorney with Fletcher, Heald, and Hildreth, who represents several LPTV clients. As a result, many LPTV operators expect the worst, being squeezed out of their channel and out of business. So the FCC is basically ignoring low-power TV, and therefore no low-power TV station right now knows whether it's going to be able to survive, says Tannenwald. It's not very comforting. The FCC is trying to clear out 120 megahertz of TV spectrum from full-power and Class A stations and sell it to wireless carriers. To do that, it came up with the incentive auction plan, which actually is two auctions in one. Broadcasters who opt to give up their spectrum will sell it to the government in a reverse auction, in which the government sets ever higher prices until it accumulates as much spectrum as it wants. The government then sells it to wireless carriers in a conventional forward auction. The reallocation would likely involve packing the remaining TV stations into the lower end of the UHF TV band, and that in turn would mean new channel assignments for many of them. Under the auction's authorizing legislation, the FCC needs to make all reasonable efforts to protect full power and Class A TV stations in their repacking, but has no obligation to other LPTV stations. Class A's are LPTV stations that enjoy the same regulatory status as full-power stations because they have agreed to provide minimum amounts of children's and locally produced programming. They account for about 25% of the more than 2,100 licensed LPTV stations in the U.S. The FCC's interpretation of that is that Congress made a decision that non-Class A low-power stations are secondary, and that's the way they have to stay, Tannenwald says. My interpretation, he continues, is a little different from that. The statute says nothing in this statute changes the rights of low-power TV stations. I don't see anything that constrains the FCC in any way with anything it wants to do. It just says the statute doesn't change their rights. The FCC is looking at ways to preserve some LPTV stations, Tannenwald says, including putting all low-power stations in a market onto one channel following the REPAC. Another solution includes protecting certain LPTVs based on criteria like how much money the station brings in or how important its content is to its market. For example, a low-power station with a high Hispanic population in its market might be protected if it offers Spanish programming. Desperate for answers from the FCC, LPTV advocacy groups want to see hard data showing there is a national spectrum crunch and want evidence that their communities will be better served if they're ultimately squeezed out of business. Show me how a large wireless company is going to better reach and speak to and communicate with my community, better than how I do it, says Rod Payne, president of the Wichita Falls, Texas-based Christian Family Network Television, which operates a Class A station. Payne is also the chairman of the Broadcast Alliance, which represents LPTV operators and aims to preserve and promote the efficient and effective use of all television broadcast spectrum. We take very seriously the license that was given to us, and with that, the responsibility that the FCC has entailed. Payne says the plan that the FCC has put forth is like something he would expect in a communist country. It's more like a confiscation and redistribution type plan, he says. They say, we're going to pull this away from you, and we are going to redistribute it. Now, the sad thing is, in a communist country, the model normally would be take it from the wealthy and distribute it among all the people. Here what we're doing, we're taking it from some little guy out there who's invested $150,000 to $200,000 or more and is really serving the people in the community. And we're saying we're going to take that from you and sell it to someone who already has a huge amount of infrastructure and an enormous amount of finance. Paul Broyles, president of the Texas-based International Broadcasting Network, which operates 10 LPTVs in the state, believes the auction and repack jeopardizes far more than just low-power stations. The International Broadcasting Network believes that going forward with the auction and repacking scheme will be chaotic, will result in the total destruction of the LPTV industry, and will lead to the demise of the entire television broadcasting industry, Broyles wrote in an email to TV NewsCheck. Not all low-power station operators share that extreme of his outlook. Eric Wotilla, GM of WMNN-LD, Cadillac, Michigan, says he would be more concerned as a low-power operator if he operated in a larger market. I wouldn't say we're out of the woods, but I certainly don't take a sky-is-falling attitude, Wotilla says. I think the real issue is for people in large markets where there are already a limited number of channels available. Wotilla says his station is in DMA 119, a relatively large geographic area in the northern half of Michigan's Lower Peninsula, where only two low-power stations are on air. Greg Herman, president of Spectrum Evolution, an LPTV advocacy group, wants the FCC to set aside some channels that low-power stations in the same market could share. In comments to the FCC, he also suggested that if a low-power station can't find another channel in a market, or if it can't find one with adequate coverage, then the FCC should allow that station to aggregate the lost population on a channel in neighboring market. If I can't be in market A, but let's say I found a channel in market B, they would then be required to grant me that channel in market B. It wouldn't necessarily give them back the community that they were in, but it would certainly keep them as viable and most certainly allow them to say that they won't end up with nothing, he says, noting that it would be tough for most LPTV stations to set up business in another market. It wouldn't necessarily give them back the community that they were in, but it would certainly keep them as viable and most certainly allow them to say that they won't end up with nothing, he says, although admitting that it would be tough economically for most LPTV stations to set up business in another market. Small broadcast operators aren't the only people concerned. Network-affiliated owners like Sinclair Broadcast Group have many LPTV stations they operate to extend the reach of their full-power stations or to carry networks in markets where there are not enough full-power stations to go around. For example, in Salt Lake City, about 30% of Sinclair's viewers come from low-powered facilities. There's a concern only because there's nothing explicitly stated by the FCC when it comes to protecting these stations, says Mark Aitken, Sinclair VP of Advanced Technology. If the FCC is willing to voice a return that says, why would we do that? Let's get that in writing. We've been through the comment and the comment reply period, but there's been no feedback that has in any way clarified any questions that have been asked of the FCC when it comes to protecting low-power stations. These are real concerns. This article was titled, Low Powers Have High Anxiety Over REPAC, by Andrew Dodson in TV News Chat.
Hi, folks. The National Radio Club is looking for a host for the 2014 convention. As you know, 2013's all set for Minneapolis, and we're geared up to show you a good time. At the request of several members, we'd like to be able to announce the location for 2014 at the 2013 meeting. Hosting a convention can be some work, as well as a lot of fun. That's apparent from the many repeat hosts we've had over the years. Within the club, there's an incredible amount of help and experience available to assist with planning. And you'll find folks volunteering to help make the event itself go smoothly. Having the club members visit your city gives you an opportunity to share what your area has to offer. It also provides a great opportunity for old DX friends to gather and swap stories. If you're interested in learning what's involved in hosting an NRC convention, please check in with Ernie Wesolowski by email. His email address is neerniew@yahoo.com. Or send Ernie a note at 13312 Westwood, one word, Lane, Omaha, Nebraska, 68144. We can help you evaluate the practical aspects of hosting a convention so that if you do decide to make a formal bid, you'll have what you need to make that decision. Why not take the first step now by learning what's involved in hosting the 2014 convention? We're not asking for a commitment at this point. We just want to know if you're interested and we can give you all the information you need. By hosting the 2014 convention, you can provide a great service to the National Radio Club.
Thanks, Mark. I'd like to address those of you who are listening on our CDs for a moment and ask you, how would you like to help the DX Audio Service in a real meaningful way? We need two things to keep us rocking and rolling and to keep us publishing. First of all, we need to get new members. Membership has dropped off due to older members passing away and also due to the economy. Now, I'd like to grow the membership. And if you can get an old member to rejoin or get somebody new to take out a subscription to the DX Audio Service, I'll add a month on to your DX Audio Service subscription. Now, this offer only applies to those receiving the Audio Service CDs and is good until September 1st of this year. Secondly, we're trying to update our PR list, but unfortunately, some of those members who passed away were instrumental in keeping those lists for us. We're looking for any and all websites, reading services, talking book services, and magazines which cater to the blind. Please send their contact information, name, address, city, state, zip, phone number, etc. to me here at the DX Audio Service. The person who sends in the most contact information will receive a special prize, and the runner-up will get some DX dollars. Now please help the club by growing our membership and getting the word out about the DX Audio Service. The National Radio Club is in its 80th year, and the DX Audio Service is in its 28th year. And we'd like to be around a little bit longer. So help us out now, won't you? Now at this time, let's go over to our second edition of the DX Audio Service. Wonderful.